Well, here we go again. Another week, another podcast. The P word, James, yes?
Yes, the P word is always good.
It is. What if they used to call that programme with Bob Holness on it?
Blockbusters.
Blockbusters.
Give me a P, Bob.
There we are. Give me a... Can I have a P, Bob? Yes. As you can hear and see, our guest this week, Pamela Ballantyne. Delighted to have you here. And, you know, as our old friend Jackie Fullerton would say, happy to be here. I'm happy to be anywhere these days.
Too true. Thank you so much. It's lovely to be at home with the Martins. When you said the P word, I thought you meant me.
Ah, yes.
Well, she's here again.
Had we rehearsed, that would have been in, of course. But when did we ever do
that? Oh, heavens, what is a rehearsal?
It's funny, you know, the strange things that come into your head. Whenever I knew we were doing this, obviously I was thinking a bit about you. And for some reason, and where did this come from?
What's coming next?
We were doing the breakfast show at Downtown. Richard was away and you were in with me. And this thing came up about flotsam and jetsam. And I said to you, have you any idea what flotsam and jetsam is? And you said to me, yes, and explained it. And I said, oh my God, thank you so much. They say every day's a school day.
Yes.
And it was.
Absolutely. But I'm just trying to think if I could still tell you what it is. I think flotsam is stuff that floats naturally and jetsam is stuff that falls off boats.
That's, yeah, you're basically right in there with that. But why on earth that should have stayed in my head?
Well, knowing your brain and the way it works, it doesn't surprise me in the slightest. That's the sort of thing that stays in your head. Because you knew me as Pamela Rolston.
I did.
Yeah.
Yes.
Going back all those years.
Going back. And I also was thinking this week, you know, there are three of us here. Mm-hmm. And the only one without an MBE put their hand up. So the big thing, and we may as well start with this, is we discussed you getting an MBE, but Pammy got one as well.
I know, I was absolutely thrilled and delighted. And also when I discovered that James was getting one too. Because, say, having known you since, you know, all those hundreds of years ago.
Yes, yes.
And James wasn't even thought of at that stage. Having you followed your career over the last few years as well, and the work that you've done. I was absolutely thrilled to see us both in the paper at the same time. And I was really, really chuffed and delighted to get the award. And also relieved I didn't have to keep it a secret anymore after 6 weeks.
I know, I found that hard too after the 6 weeks too.
I didn't tell a soul. I broke on Christmas night and told my sister. Mm-hmm. And I told my partner on Boxing Night as well. And that was it. And then broke the news on the 29th of December when it was being announced to be put out to the world.
Yes, James said to me, Dad, you have to keep it on the DL.
Yeah.
Right.
The down low.
Down low.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that Absolutely. Was that.
Well, a friend of mine told me afterwards, you know, there were a few people who were a bit, why didn't you tell me? It doesn't actually say anywhere to keep it a secret, but it is sort of the thing that you know that you keep a secret. But a friend of mine said, no, you were just right, because as soon as you tell somebody a secret, it's no longer a secret.
That's right. That's correct.
And if it was hard enough for me to keep it a secret, what was it going to be like for somebody else?
The only person that I told was actually my mum and my dad, first off.
Because they were there when you got your letter.
Yes. Yeah. Well, my mum was, and I was actually going to the football match, and it arrived, and I was like, oh, this is amazing, you know, fantastic. Was that feeling the same thing as you?
Oh, 100%. I mean, it was, It was so nice to get, you see a letter sitting on the doormat going cabinet office and you go, okay. Don't tell me they need another prime minister.
At least at least it's not from the revenue.
Exactly. Yeah. Or another Mrs. Ballantyne, you've been doing whatever speed it was up whatever road it was again. Yes. So it was just to read it and then read it through again was just so lovely. And then, of course, you don't hear another thing until we got a phone call on Boxing Night from the Press Association camera boys and said, look, we're coming out, this is the way we do it and whatever. So I thought, well, it is happening now. So that's why I was able to sort of, I thought I'd better tell the other half just before he found out on the news, because then he'd go, what other secrets are you keeping from me?
Well, there was always that. We got into this when you were saying I'd known you when you were Pamela Rolston.
Yeah.
Right? And that, the other thing I've been thinking a lot about is your father, your late father, Wee Bob, yes, as we always called him.
Not to his face, I hate him.
No, no. And I have never known anyone who had such a heightened sense of injustice if things didn't go his way, right? So picture the scene, Christmas Eve morning. I have done breakfast on downtown. I've driven to Belfast and I've pulled into a well-known wine merchant's car park. I pull in. There's no spaces, so I pull in at the front door and beside me pulls up this car. The driver gets out, opens the door, and your father gets out and he says to me, ah, young Martin, good day to go and buy some wine, shall we? And we walk through the door, right? We walk through the door of this place. And he immediately turns to me like the world has ended and says, damn it all, there's a queue.
Quite, yeah.
Whereupon this guy comes rushing out of a side office and whisks the two of us away, sets us down and produces a schooner of sherry and pours us each a sherry.
This is the first I've heard of this story.
We're sitting there and he goes off, only to return 15, 20 minutes later and say, well, gentlemen, your order is in the boot of your respective cars. Would you like another sherry before you leave? And, well, all right, it's Christmas, so diddle-doot, and there we go. But, you know...
Well, I have to put out, he didn't have a driver, and, you know, that was this. He was obviously coming from one of his events, and somebody had said, I'll give him a lift, or whatever, but, or one of the things that he was involved in. I have to, you know, Dad was what I referred to as a professional Northern Ireland businessman, started work at the age of 14, as a tea boy in Cantle and Cochrane and retired as chairman at the age of 67. So he worked his way up and he was involved in a lot of boards and that sort of thing. And one of them was the police authority. So I'd imagine at one of their meetings before Christmas, there might have been more than the sherries that you had been taken, and somebody decided the gentleman probably needed lifts home.
Yeah, well, it's a very handy thing to have.
Oh, absolutely. Because Dad drank... He would have had the odd beer and he loved his whiskey. Mm. And he would have had what he called his mixed martinis on a Sunday, which was sweet vermouth, dry vermouth. And he topped mum's up with ginger ale and his was just the sweet vermouth and dry vermouth. Wine was completely alien to him. He learnt, but he, I always remember mum telling me he had some customers out for dinner one night and the Four Winds was his go-to place. And he ordered the bottle of wine and the waiter came and poured the wine. And Dad took a sip and went, I think that's the 68. I ordered the 67. I went, oh, Mr. Rolston, you're absolutely right. Terribly sorry. And off they went and they came back for the rubber. The napkin had fallen off the neck and he saw the date on it. Just, right, we'll try one here.
Yeah, that's yeah. Well, fair play.
Absolutely.
Well, he, you know... I always thought he was always very welcoming. Mm. If we went into your house, he'd come in, and, you know, he would come out from behind his newspaper. And
yep. That was it. The paper was always spread on the kitchen table.
Edna, did you offer the boys a drink?
Uh-huh.
You know?
There was an ashtray with a Hamlet sitting in it in the kitchen. There was another one in the sitting room with a Hamlet in it as well. But you also talked that there was another story. Dad was an office on one of the boards that he was on in town, and he was going into town, and Mum said, look, would you nip into Marksy's? The kids are going back to school. Need some new blue school knickers for Susie. Would you go into Marksy's and get them? So Dad, being unaccustomed to visiting the sort of junior age, and he always wore the trilby, and he had an umbrella and the raincoat. And seemingly he got down, and he had this uncanny knack of people, you know, looking helpless and people coming up and saying, can I help you? And of course, everything was self-service.
Yes.
And he stood in the middle of Marksy's, and this lady came up and he said, can I help you, sir? He went, indeed, knickers, blue, aged 11, come with me. And sure enough, he got his knickers blue, aged 11.
Was it half price or was
No. Full price.
Full price.
Full price, absolutely. Yeah.
But that all, I was going to say it seems a lifetime ago, but it was a lifetime ago.
Yeah. I mean, this year is 40 years at UTV.
Mm-hmm.
I started in Downtown Radio in 1978.
Yes.
And then went to BBC very briefly in 83 and then into UTV in 84.
Yes.
So it was a lifetime. I mean, I was 19 years of age and coming from the College of Business Studies, having done a private secretary's course there and started work as John Rossborough's secretary, John, who was the head of programmes. And I was secretary to all you boys, all the DJs as well.
Yeah, that's right. And then you moved upstairs with Harry.
Yes, because I initially was with John on the upstairs office, and then I moved into the features department with Harry Castles.
Yes.
Yeah, but in those days, you know, I may have been John's secretary, but there were days you'd been down, they're a bit short-staffed in sales, would you go down there? And because I could wire plugs and I loved fiddling with sound effects, I would be in engineering as well. And, you know, you'd know what it was like yourself. Everybody did every job, because Downtown was only 3 years old when I started.
Once you started broadcasting, I mean, increasingly, you were on site, and if they needed sudden cover, you were it.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I started. They, as you know, in the time, they didn't really have proper newsreaders. It was all the journalists read the news.
Yeah.
And being the late 70s, there was a lot of news in Northern Ireland, and they twigged one day, there's nobody to read the news. And I think David Sloan was head of news at the time, and he said, that news reader, or that news secretary, she can speak a bit, and wheeled me down. And then, remember, Linda Jane, God rest her, would phone me up, go, I need to nip to the loo, Pammy, would you come down? Just press the buttons, I'll be back. And occasionally she'd go for a coffee and forget to come back. So you were sort of just pushing that, and then I thought every now and then I better just say it. So I used to do Linda Jane impersonations.
Yeah.
And just go, that was it. I fact did her programme one day. She'd slept in, and I did her programme for half an hour, and her dad didn't even know she wasn't there.
Joss, I think his name was, wasn't it?
Well,
oh, no.
They were highly entertaining days, I have to say.
They were.
But also, the reason I got drafted in, there was a clause in my contract of employment, final clause, anything to assist the smooth running of broadcasting, which is then they gave me a programme at 5 o'clock in the morning.
I know.
And then I had to go and work in the features office until 12 o'clock. Well, I tried to get the programme ready for the next day. You know, we used to go and get our own records out of the library.
Right.
But sometimes somebody wouldn't have the key, and the lovely Cherry, who was in charge of the library, wouldn't be in at that time. So you'd have to sort of try and get the timings right so you could do some work. And then, I was double jobbing.
And it was all, somebody said to me, what was the main difference between working at Downtown and U105? And I said, Downtown was fun. And it was.
It was.
Now, that may well have been because it was a young station. It was a new thing.
We hadn't a clue what we were doing either.
You know, it was great fun.
Uh-huh. Well, it was huge fun. I mean, the stories that, you know, and if you think, I mean, we used to have dogs' dinners, the Downtown Old Girls Society.
Yes.
And if you think of all, you know, like Wendy Austin, Jeannie Johnson, Kate Smith, Maggie Taggart, Linda McCauley, you know, they were all started in Downtown. Likewise, you know, with the guys as well. And the stories that would go on in the crack. I mean, my Jipple, who I married, and he used to do the first program.
Oh, right.
He was on very early in the morning.
Yeah.
And then he did the dinner spinner.
Yes.
And the boys would go out maybe after everybody had been off air, might have gone down and had a wee drink or two. And then Big T was on in the evening and they would come back up and just see what Trevi was doing. And then they might just decide that they would play the commercials they like listening to, not the ones that have been booked and paid for. And went, oh, no, let's play this one. Boom. And on they would go. It was absolutely barking.
I used to do the chart show on a Sunday afternoon. And it was getting near the end of the programme. And, of course, you had to do the rundown. This week's chart, number 40, it's an up 9 places to 31, is this right? So I'm reading the chart, and Jibbo, T and Linda came in, and they're doing everything to try and make me corpse and laugh and whatever, and I'm managing to get through it. So eventually, they came over and lit the piece of paper that I was reading. So it's burning, and I'm trying to get all the stuff in before it's burnt. Right, but I'm doing okay with that. So when I about got to number 10, they overturned the waste paper bin in the studio and put it over my head so I couldn't see to read the rest of it, you know? I mean, it was hilarious.
It was. I mean, I remember being put in the bin once by Harry Castle's, also God bless him, because I'd come back from a holiday and I'd been a bit sunburnt, and he put his hand on my back. He was sort of leaning over to something, and he went, "You're not wearing a bra." I said, "Neither are you, and you have more need of one than I have." Boom, boom, folded. But he used to get copies. Harry was the features editor, and he would be sent preview copies of magazines and books and whatever. And they would always come with press releases. This is the article. And Penthouse was one of the magazines that would be sent every month to Harry with a press release saying, the article this week is. So as his assistant, I was a bit worried, so I used to staple all the other pages together the whole way around, so he could only read the article.
Yes.
Thanks.
Harry was quite a rotund chap.
He was.
Like myself in those days. And Harry had a brilliant sign up in his office, which read, "Diets begin tomorrow."
Yeah.
You remember that?
Oh, totally, absolutely. But no, it was a great fun place to work. I mean, don't get me wrong, it was very professional too. I mean, Cool FM then came out of Downtown, and I mean, if you think of the people, as I say, who've been through the doors and it's still going strong, it was great.
It was good fun, but as you say, you know, not at the expense of the programmes.
Yeah.
And the figures proved that.
Oh, absolutely. And the staff and the bosses were good, because I started, it was David Hannon.
Yes.
Was MD, whose son, or his nephew, Neil Hannon, was Divine Comedy.
Uh-huh.
And then Ivan Tinman was the MD. And you may curl your lip. But he was really good to me because I was approached during the 5 o'clock in the morning program. I got a phone call one day. Don Anderson, who was head of BBC Northern Ireland.
Donny Andy
was driving into, and he used to work in downtown, and he was driving into BBC one day, and he heard me on the radio, and he knew that they had a slot coming up at 9 o'clock in the morning. A guy called Stuart was leaving, and he rang and said, would I be interested in coming for an audition? And I went along for the audition, and I told Ivan Tinman that I was going for the, and he said, look, let me know how it goes. And Downtown had sent me, do you remember they sent me to London for 3 months?
Yes.
To the Capital Radio Broadcasting School, which was brilliant fun, great crack. And BBC offered me the job, and I went to Ivan and said, look, they've offered me the job. And he said, as your boss, I will say, we have invested a lot of money in you. We think that you've got a great future with us. We think you should stay. But he said, as your friend, nobody here is going anywhere anytime soon. And if it was me, I would grab it with both hands. So go with my blessing, which I thought,
yeah,
that was a really nice thing to do.
It was.
Yeah.
And you went there, and then you had a stint at the BBC, which...
was not happy.
No, it wasn't. And, I mean, it wasn't happy, but... in the great scheme of things, it didn't matter.
Yeah. But I mean, it was... I mean, we'll not go into what the ins and outs of it, because there's nobody here for a right of reply.
Yeah.
So it was just... it was not what I was used to. I remember meeting somebody in the corridor on my first day going, oh, hello. And I went, oh, hello. And they stopped and looked me up and down. It was like being on the tube in London. Mm. You passed people in the corridor and people didn't speak. It was... it was like working for the civil service almost. You had to write things out in quadruple and triplicate, and I just, it just wasn't for me. But well, there were lovely, like Cherry McElwain was there at the time, Frank Mitchell then was there, Louis Edmondson, so people I knew, and you know, they were really, you know, the workers were really nice people.
When I was there, it was like a series of little fiefdoms that worked independent of each other. Whereas in Downtown, it was more of a team thing, you know?
And as you say, I mean, it was 3 months after I started. I was called in actually on my day off by my direct boss to say that they... I couldn't quite understand what he was saying. Then I twigged, oh, he's talking about restructuring. Oh, I don't have a programme anymore. The time slot's gone.
Yeah.
So, but they wanted me to stay on for the next 2 months to work to the end of the year. But it was the first time in about 10 years UTV had a job going in continuity. And Joanne Woods, who worked in continuity in UTV, was had been going out with somebody from Downtown, and they just got talking. She said, what's Pamela doing? I don't know. So got in touch with me, and I left the Beeb in the December, and I went down to Joanne and had, you know, chatted to her and had an audition then, and started in the freelance team in March 1984.
I remember at that time thinking, if ever anybody had got their dream job, it was you with that, because you genuinely enjoyed television.
Yeah.
And you watched everything.
Yeah. I mean, you'd have seen the Radio Times and TV Times. There were two at the time. I would go through it with a highlighter.
Yeah.
Stuff that I was going to record and what I could watch and... how I could watch that programme at that and then still... love TV.
And where did you go from continuity? When did you move out of continuity downstairs to programming?
Well, it was all sort of all at the same time, because I freelanced for a year and a half. And then it just happened. I mean, to be right place, right time has been... I've been so lucky. And Jackie Barclay was presenting Farming Ulster at the time, and she had just been in to see Michael Beattie, who was looking after programmes, and told him she was pregnant and would be going off maternity leave, and he was going, oh, what are we going to do? And I just happened to walk past his office, and he went, oh.
She'll do.
So it took a year and a half, and actually I was on the freelance team for, say, a year and a half, and Rose Neal was still working as, she was on contractor staff at UTV. And I've known Rose since we were 14. And she said to me one day, she said, look, I've been approached, I'm going to the Beeb, get your application in for my job. So I put an application in, and Nick, who was our direct line boss in UTV, went, why has Pamela applied for a full-time job? Oh, opened the next letter. Oh, that's why she's applied. Yeah. As he then read Roses.
Yeah.
I'm terribly sorry, I'm leaving. So they then took me on sort of full-time continuity and news reading. So I was doing that, and I was also doing Farming Ulster. And I was also, so I mean, I was in continuity for years, because continuity was also news reading, sport, weather, as well as doing the, coming up on UTV, you've got blah, blah, blah. And we were, of course, were all in Vision as well, which was unusual for TV stations. And I just sort of kept doing different programmes. So I can't even remember when that the continuity sort of stopped and I moved up into the newsroom full time, working towards UTV Life, which was on at 5:30, and you know, just doing features. And so it's been one of those programs. You know, I've done Telethon, which was 27 hours of continuous broadcasting, say Farming Ulster, RPM, which, because I love my motorsport and my cars as well, as you know, did the Ulster Schools Quiz. You know, just lots of lovely programs. Great fun too.
What's your favourite one? Your favourite programme?
Do you know, I really loved doing Farming Ulster, because I learnt so much. And having, as a kid, we used to have a holiday home in Ballyhalbert.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, from about the age of 5, I think it was, until I was about 15. And there was Caldwell's farm was just around the corner. And we used to go and help out in the farm. And I just, you know, I love animals, and I just, you know, I just found it, the business of farming was really interesting. But I loved doing Hot Pursuits as well. It was an outdoor pursuit game show. And people said, gosh, you must be really fit. And they only ever saw me run two paces off camera. It was the people competing were knocking their pans in to run up mountains and stuff. And I'm going, yes, all you need to do is that, boom, run, gone. That was me. As my mum always used to say, you may not be any bloody good at anything, but you always look the part.
I think that's a great answer. Yeah.
But also the opportunities for Hot Pursuits, we did a Christmas show. And the director said, producer director said to me, David said, where do you fancy? Sam Moritz or Jamaica? I said, oh, we're talking November time. Think Jamaica for me, nice and warm. So we filmed in Jamaica. And then with RPM, I say, loved my motorsport and loved travelling the length and breadth of Ireland and Scotland and the Isle of Man, covering the rallies. And we went to Barbados to film the rally carnival there. So the opportunities have just been brilliant. So, I mean, I love getting out and about. I love meeting people, which is why I love doing the programme that I'm doing at the moment, because we just, you get to meet some really nice people like yourself, James.
Well, that's really lovely of you to say.
Not at all.
It's really nice when you have a programme. It's slow, but it's also the best. What was your best one from that?
Oh, flip. That's a toughie. I always say the best programmes are the ones that are the least expected. Like people that aren't well known that you get good stories from. Those are the ones that I really love doing, that you sort of get to meet people that you wouldn't normally. Like doing Spirit of Northern Ireland, I love doing that, because the stories that come through are just, you know, and you feel pride of being part of that.
And it's out though.
It's out there, and it's getting people who deserve the recognition, that recognition. So it's, you know, there's so many things that I've done that have been, you really, yeah, afterwards you're gone, do you know what, that was, I really like that. Mm-hmm. And it, but mm-hmm. because of the people that are there telling their stories.
You were in, I actually remember one pantomime. I'm not going to say too much.
Yeah.
But you were the fairy.
I was the fairy godmother in Cinderella. Loved it.
When was that?
That was, 1997? 96, 97, I'm thinking. Yeah. So it wasn't exactly yesterday. It was quite, and I remember opening the script. I took the script on holiday with me. Thought, well, I'll reread. And opened it up, first page, fairy godmother. Second page, fairy godmother. Third page. And I went, oh, I was used to reading autocue. I'd never learnt lines in my puff. And you know what it's like to learn lines. And when you're there on your own, it's... But it was... So, and I was going, right, where's the autocue? Can we see autocue anywhere? But, oh, it was brilliant. It was great fun.
It was a great fun to walk with May McFaggery, then.
It was, because John, a.k.a. May, is so professional. And he knew how terrified I was. And he minded me. And he looked after it, made sure that, you know, because when people go into those things, and you know what it's like, when you first arrive on set, for the very first time, everybody else has their jobs, and you're the new boy. And you go, well, I don't know what to do, where do I go? And John, it was like that for me going into the theatre. I'd never done that at school. I wasn't on stage. I did the lighting and the sound in school for the school plays. So I didn't know any of the, you know, where do you stand, or the shorthand of what things are called.
Mm-hmm.
So John was brilliant. And I was working with Cannon and Ball, and they are just, they were two legends as well. Such gentlemen as well. And when they found out it was the first time I'd ever been on the stage, they minded me as well. And they couldn't have been nicer. It was a brilliant opportunity.
Was that feeling lovely?
Yeah, it was. It was really nice. And you know, the fear that runs through you, and every night. And then you sort of get a wee bit more relaxed, and you know, the half time we'd be sitting up in Cannon and Ball's dressing room just telling a few yarns and having a bit of crack, and you know, might have had a wee beer. And
he does, way.
And then we was wondering, you'd get the 5 minutes call, everybody, 5 minutes call. So I'm the first one on in the second act, and then it's into a big dance scene. And we were all sitting there, and the first thing we heard was the overture music for the second half. We're two floors up. Fairy's crown is sitting on the table. Fairy's wings are somewhere else. Fairy's wand. I belted down the stairs. I could have beaten Linford Christie in the full frock. And it was like that scene in Risky Business where Tom Cruise slides through the door as I came through. And the babes are all there waiting to dance. And I'm going, you know, the way I pop. And I was like, whoop. It was wild, but huge fun. So you'll know yourself. Whenever the nerves leave you, that's a problem.
Yeah,
you've always got to have that wee bit of, here we go, we've got to do this.
And now, what you mean? As we can finish this sentence of, we're going to meet the nicest people who would give us our award.
Yeah, I mean, and we don't know who it's going to be. And I know there's only three. So it's either going to be Charles or William or Anne.
Mm-hmm.
I'm delighted, you know, because we're a bit worried there. I think they might have a bit of a backlog because the King and the Prince of Wales have been out of action due to the Princess of Wales' ill health and the King's ill health. So Anne's been the only one working. So, but now they're sort of getting back to work. They might get on with letting us know when we're going to London. Would be great if we went together.
Be even better, even nice.
You and I'd be standing in the corner having a natter, and then they'd be going, where are those two? Oh, sorry. Sorry, sir. We're here now. Yeah. Have you been practicing your bow?
I need to keep practicing, and okay. I need to practice a pinky. This is your first time of meeting them.
Well, I've been very lucky in my career to. And also through the different charities to have met a few. I've met Anne before. I haven't met Prince Charles, King Charles or Prince William. But I've had lunch with the Queen and Prince Philip at Hillsborough Castle, which I thought it was going to be me and 599 close personal friends. But it was 20 of us sitting around the dining room table. And to this day, still don't know why I was invited, but it was lovely. I've met Edward on quite a few occasions. He comes over and is involved in one of the charities that I'm involved in. So it's been lovely to meet. And they are, I mean, in fact, the last conversation I had with Prince Edward was about men running through the streets in mankinis.
Mm.
As you do.
That was the cutest name drop we've had today. The last conversation. They all come... they all call him Eddie as well, which I think is hilarious. Uh-huh. But, you know, there we go.
Yes,
do you have a preference for Buckingham Palace or Windsor Castle?
Well, I've also been very lucky to have been in Buckingham Palace a few times. And I've never been to Windsor. But I think the kudos of going to the palace is lovely. Although I have a photograph on my mantelpiece of me aged 18 with my sister who would have been 13 at the time, 12 or 13, and mum and dad getting his CBE. And you look like you're standing in a railway station because it's just the metal sort of backdrop. So it doesn't actually scream Buckingham Palace to you, but it's lovely. And we did, I mean, first thing I had to do is, right, I've got to go to the loo. Because you just have to go and have a look around the loos of the palace. And have to, I mean, the ones that we were in were like the old wooden wall-to-wall seat with a hole cut in it. And then you pulled this handle up and the bottom fell out of the loo. Little things you remember when you're 18. Little
things you do when you're 18 is something, isn't it?
Going for a wee in Buckingham Palace. Well, have you a preference?
No, I really haven't. I've been to Buckingham Palace garden party. Big garden, but I've seen pictures of Windsor Castle, but I don't have a preference for which one it is.
It's just an honour to be invited.
It's still really nice.
Yeah? Do you know who that is sitting beside you? I mean, is he just one of the... Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
I'm
know.
Just a commoner.
Listen, I've been saying that for years. No, it's just really nice just to invite my family because we can have a family holiday as well. But I'm sure it's going to be the same as you, a family holiday.
I don't know how many we're allowed to bring because I've heard everything from 1 to 3. So we'll wait and see how many.
I believe it's 3.
Well, I'm hoping for 3.
Yeah, because then it can be Suzanne, myself and Daniel.
Lovely.
And that would be great.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we shall see. If the MBE was the highlight of your year, the tricky part of the year was obviously the illness.
Yeah. I mean, that was, I mean, the juxtaposition of timings was incredible because on the 29th of December 2022, I was told I had breast cancer. And on the 29th of December 2023, it was announced that I had an MBE. So a full on year. And why the date sticks in my head so much is the 29th of December is my niece's birthday. So she turned 30 and I totally ruined her birthday party in 2022. It's been a challenging year. Still having treatment and I've got another 4 treatments to go. So I should be finished right about the middle of April, touch wood. And that should be, fingers crossed, me done. But I mean there's so many people who are worse off than I am with, you know, getting the diagnosis. You know, it was all done so quickly. I had the mammogram, I had no signs of lump disfiguration, discolouring, nothing, none of the signs that people say you have to look out for. And went for the mammogram on the 28th of November, called back in on the 20th of December, diagnosed on the 29th of December, was told I would probably have surgery on the 25th of January, but then got called in the week before for a chat and they said I have what's called, it's the HER2 cell, which as well as being estrogen fed, which means it's just breast cancer, it also can travel it round. I just say it goes for a dander around the body. So that's why they didn't do the surgery until after I'd had the chemo. And the chemo's totally shrank the tumours away. I had tumour in my right boob and I had 16 lymph nodes removed and 3 of them showed signs that there had been cancer there too. So it was all done so quickly. I mean, my surgery was in July. And so if you think that was sort of from December to July, I had my radiotherapy in August and I'm now just getting these injections once every 3 weeks. I mean, it's been so quick and done, but, you know, it's been trying.
Yeah, it certainly has. But You also, it's one of those things that you want to keep private.
Yeah.
And when you live in a goldfish bowl, that isn't easy. But you manage very well on that score. One of the reasons being that you never seem to be off. You kept doing the programme.
Yeah, I mean, my oncologist said that she found people, because I said I was adamant I wanted to keep working. And every time I asked her a question, I mean, she's brilliant. She phones before every treatment and you just talk through whatever. Mm-hmm. So you can be on the phone to her for nearly half an hour times, depending on what symptoms you've had. And, you know, they said to me from the start, the side effects can be horrendous, but we have medication to help. Don't hide, just let us know. So, you know, I took whatever drugs they gave me, and UTV were really good, and they swapped a couple of my recording days to coincide so that I could record in the morning and go for my chemo in the afternoon, because then the side effects hit sort of the day after, pretty much. So I just wanted to keep going, and Lucy, my oncologist, said that she found that people who kept working dealt with the side effects better, dealt with the symptoms, seemed to get on with, you know, the cancer seemed to react better because you keep busy. One thing that it said after I had my surgery is, do not lie in your bed. You know, get up, go about your business if you can.
Yes.
The one thing I've had friends, and it was sort of the headline that got picked out in the paper when I wrote my story. I've had friends who've been diagnosed with cancer, and I have seen how people treat them. You get treated as the illness. Mm-hmm. You get treated as the disease. You get treated as, you know, it doesn't matter what it is. You know, you are treated as something. But I kept saying, I'm still me. Yes, I have something growing in my right boob that I didn't know was there, and we're going to get rid of it.
Yes.
But I'm still me, so don't treat me any differently. And I had to have a word with a couple of my mates,
mm-hmm.
who were, well, how are you? Yeah. Grand.
Yeah.
It's just nice being partner, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's one of my friends, we all have a fairly wicked sense of humour. And one of my mates rang me one day, and this, after my hair had started falling out. And she said, I'm nearly coming out in sympathy with you. What? Why? And she said, well, I was drying my hair and the filter had come off the back of my hairdryer. And I got distracted because my dad was out talking to the guy from the water board. And I turned around and my hair got sucked up inside the hairdryer. And I went, you bucky, that's really dangerous. What'd you do that for? And I gave her buckets to her. And she said, yeah, I had to unplug it and go outside with a pair of scissors and get my dad to cut my hair out of the hairdryer. So she said, I've got this. I said, for goodness sake. And she said, well, it happened a year ago. The filter came off. I said, you've had that for you. That is so dangerous. You need to go and get a new hairdryer. She said, well, could I not have yours? Because you'll hardly need it for a while.
well, thanks for that. Enough, yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Yes. On that subject, I mean, I saw you when you had the wig. Helen.
Yes. After Helen Mirren. And then the other one was called, the second one was called To Helen, as in To Helen Back.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I saw you then when you had almost no hair.
Mm-hmm.
It was like the Telly Savalas look.
Yeah.
Right. And then I saw you a few weeks ago, and I mean, look at you now. Your hair has all grown back.
I know, it's been cut six times.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it never looks like it's been away.
Yeah, I know. It's funny because I'm looking back at photos because I have, mm-hmm. I've taken photos pretty much the whole way. And I knew, I didn't shave it off for ages. And it was something that one of the other nurses had said, look, don't rush into getting your head shaved. Just go your own speed. And I had enough to keep me going.
Yeah.
And then I took a photograph one day when I was getting my chemo. And I looked at the photo. And first of all, the look that was looking back at me was my mother when she was 80. And also my hair was like Rab C. Nesbitt in the Hamlet ad with the comb over.
Yes.
And
yes.
I went, Oh, heck, that has to go. James, you need to Google this ad.
Okay.
Grab C. Nesbitt, Hamlet ad. You'll know what I mean whenever it's just like wispy bits.
It was in the photo booth.
Every time he tried to get the photo, boom, something would happen.
That's right.
And he was combing the hair. So I knew that's when I had to shave it. And Paul Stafford, who's my hairdresser, I mean, he helped shape Helen. I mean, Therese from Tresses was brilliant in getting me the wig. And then Paul, he just did the final bit of styling on it. And then I said, right, rang him one day and said, right, today's the day. We've got to get this. The hair's got to go. And he kept saying, and I took Helen off and he said, right, are you ready for that? I said, just get on with it. Just,
boom, boom.
And he said, well, funnily enough, the majority, he's had to do this with a lot of his clients. And he said that it's the husbands or the partners who take it worse than the person who's losing the hair. Now, a lot of people, like, my hair has been my signature for years, but it was 2 weeks to the day from my first chemo when I'm washing my hair and I went, seriously, is that all? I mean, and I just started giggling in the shower. Is that all I'm getting? 2 weeks? Is that? And then I was thinking, oh God, this is going to block up the plug. So I sort of went into
the must be a nice closet. Cover season.
It was great just with myself, you know, seriously.
And
as you do, yes.
I mean, are you at that stage now where you're saying, right, I have been literally to hell and back, so I'm going to have as much heaven as I can have for the rest of my life?
Well, you know me, I haven't exactly been shy in that department anyway.
No.
So I look upon last year as being a wee blip and normal service will be resumed.
Has been resumed,
yeah. I mean, I wasn't obviously allowed to travel. My nephew got married in Hong Kong in November and it was just, I still feel I need to be close to the NHS.
Yes.
So I've been lucky in that, I went over to stay with some friends in Whitstable. My friend Siobhan had rented a house there. It was a beautiful part of the world. Then I went to stay in Spain for a few days. And I've been to a friend's house in Mallorca for a few days and went to Gran Canaria for a few days. And I've got holidays booked this year because I love traveling. I love the sun, but I've got to be really careful with my skin because it's very sensitive. Mm. With the radiotherapy as well, it can burn your skin quite a lot. So it's a factor 50 and just have to be careful in the sun.
That reminds me, James, of when you were filming Margiela.
Oh, here it comes, I know.
There was a break and we went to Spain and they said that
I wasn't allowed to get the tan.
Oh, no.
Because of Canura.
Oh.
And Mum was like, oh, I'm going to be on the beach getting a tan. And I'm like, thanks, Mum, for walking it in. I had to find like the biggest hat you can think of. You thought I was playing golf in the bare day. But anyway, and I wasn't even allowed to break a leg. Uh-huh. You know, so it was actually really hard. But I'm saying those experiences, not just walking with my dad on the radio, but also it was nice to watch something like School of Winter Corner on TV when I was wee. I loved that because you can see different schools and you can sing.
Yeah.
I think I was on it once, I think.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that memory was fantastic too.
Oh, absolutely, 100%. I mean, the memories, and you know, the memories your dad's coming up with, and I'm sort of going, God heavens, I've forgotten about that. Now, I've kept diaries throughout my life and they're up in the roof space and they're, you know, I have them. So it's brilliant, you know, every now and then. It is like my version nearly of watching cats on YouTube. I go up to get something out of the roof space. All my evening dresses are up there. And then I just go, what year did I do that? And then about an hour later, I'm realising that I've got a numb bum from sitting on the wooden floor of my roof space. And then I'm going, what did I come up here for in the first place?
Well, what I find in myself looking out in the roof space are boxes of 12-inch vinyl.
I've got those as well. I've got my 7 inches and my 12 inches. And the first, we used to go to Sounds Around, the record shop, and Caroline Music as well. And, you know, in the good old days when you could go in and listen to music. But I was, one of my summer jobs was in Smith's Records. And I was, loved David Cassidy when I was a teenager. And then my brother went to boarding school in England, and he had a much more eclectic taste in music. And that sort of influenced me. Like, Frup, which I actually never realised that Frup were actually a Belfast band, but they're a brilliant band. Loved Horselips.
Yeah.
Genesis, yeah. Early Genesis. Loved those. So singles I didn't really know about. And I got record tokens for Christmas, and I went into Smith's Records to buy a couple of singles.
Yes.
And because I think it was for £1, so it was 50p a single at the time. And I thought, I don't even really know what they are. So I've bought number one and number two in the charts, My Sweet Lord and the Pushbike Song.
Yes.
By the Mixtures.
Yes.
The Pushbike Song by the Mixtures and My Sweet Lord, George Harrison.
Oh, nice.
But that was one of the lovely things also about Downtown, was the demo records that we would get in. Mm-hmm. On the, I mean, everybody's talking now about coloured vinyl. If you think of it, I mean, yeah, the coloured vinyl that I must have up in the roof space.
The picture discs that we have upstairs. Yeah. But the other thing is that back in those days, the record pluggers who came over.
Yes.
Wincy Willis.
Yes.
Who was the TV weather girl in the end.
Uh-huh.
And she worked for DJM.
Uh-huh.
Elton John's label.
That's
Dick
right.
James Music. Yep. You know, as it was. Simon Kyle.
Yep.
Was the plugger for RCA.
Uh-huh. And there was, it was a guy, Simon Drake. Do you remember Simon Drake? He was, he became an illusionist.
That's right.
There was Tony the Greek.
Yeah.
From Island Records.
And the big Scottish fella, Jim somebody.
Yes. Oh.
He was great lad, yeah, actually.
Oh, the, I mean, it was, but what was really funny was they would come over to Downtown, and you'd always recognise the newbies, because we'd take them out for lunch.
Yes.
And we'd go to the Strangford Arms. And coming up to about a quarter to 2 o'clock, they would be downing pints like it was going out of fashion.
That's right.
And then we would go up to the bar and order another round of drinks. Because in England at the time, the bars shut at, they were only open from 12 to 2.
Yeah.
Whereas we were open all afternoon.
Yeah.
And they were absolutely blutered by 2:30. And we had just gradually kept it ticking over for the afternoon.
And plus, it's just nice to enjoy it.
Yes.
You know.
Do you remember Mick Clarkin?
I do remember Mick Clarkin.
Ritz, yeah. Records.
Yeah.
Right, they had an office in Covent Garden, and Suzanne and I were in London, and she wanted to go shopping. And we went up to Covent Garden, and I saw the Ritz office, and I said, oh, there's Ritz, must go in and say hello to Mick. And I went in. So I ended up going to the Horseshoe Bar with Mick, and Suzanne went shopping.
That's perfect.
And the guy comes over and says, can I help you? I said, I'll have a pint. And Mick says, no, there'll be no pints. Right. I'll have a vodka and tonic. No, there'll be no mixers. And the guy, I said, right, I'll have a Southern Comfort with ice. I'm sorry, we don't have Southern Comfort. He said,
that's why my dad wasn't with you.
I'll give you Canadian Club. It's the same. And Clarkin says, it's not the effing same. And he hands him £2 £20 notes, and he says, Cob, go to the off license and get a bottle of Southern Comfort.
Oh gosh, those days, because I was there was, do you remember John Pearson used to come over from Polydor Records?
Oh yes.
And I was going out with John, and but that was, he was bringing one of his artists over to play at Lakeslip Castle, and the artist was Wild Willie Barrett.
Oh,
it was John,
yeah,
Otway and Wild Willie, yeah, Barrett. Yeah. And Lakeslip had, the headliners were The Police and Squeeze.
That's right.
So I picked them up at Dublin Airport in my Mini and drove them to Lakeslip. And after the gig, we were all in the back courtyard of Lakeslip Castle.
Yes.
And Jules Holland had a keyboard on his knee.
Yeah.
And this jam session just started with the boys from Police and Different Tilbrook and
Jules Holland
and well, Willie Barrett and John. And I'm like, what in the name of all that's holy am I doing here? It was just incredible. And being, I mean, we have the photographs of us backstage at Slane when Thin Lizzy landed in the helicopter.
On the hell with Kirsty McCall.
No, it was Hazen O'Connor and Wes McGoon.
But Kirsty McCall was with Philip at
that's
the time.
Right. Yeah. And so I have those. I came across those photos the other day because I was down. I was working with the my child's family who have Slane Castle just about it. Now, my friend's cousin is Ricky Warwick, who's the lead singer of Thin Lizzy, now Black Star Riders. And so it's just amazing how these things come around. But we'd never seen. And you two were like way down on the list of headliners. I mean, it was Thin Lizzy were the big.
Lizzy figures. Were massive. One of the best Slanes ever.
Yeah. And we went down in a minibus from Dundonald Taxis, a red minibus from Dundonald Taxis.
Yes.
And we just
never mind, man, no stay.
I mean, we're backstage fast, the taxi driver didn't.
Yeah.
But in those days, you just, and you went.
Yes. I remember our friend Linda McCauley, who didn't.
MBE, by the way.
No, always indeed, who didn't normally go to outdoor things in fields, but she had a penchant for Freddie Mercury, and she went with us to Queen.
Brilliant.
And
yeah. Oh, they were absolutely. It was been the opportunities that we were given were just phenomenal, and you know, I remember sitting, having dinner with Leo Sayre and, not at the same time, Chris Rea in the Conway Hotel, because if they were playing the King's Hall, they would stay there.
Yeah.
I actually had my wedding reception in the Conway Hotel, which is now apartments.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Yes.
But it was, you know, we were just, you know, in those days, very few bands would come to Northern Ireland because of the Troubles, obviously. But those that did, everybody was so appreciative of the fact that they made the effort to come.
Leo Sayre was one of the first
he
to
was,
come.
Yeah.
And he did the King's Hall. And he's halfway through the show and security's everywhere. And Leo's talking to the audience. And this guy out of the audience just wandered onto the stage. How he got through the security, nobody knew. And the whole place held its breath. And he walked over to Leo Sayre, stuck his hand out and said, "Thanks for coming, Leo," and walked off.
Yeah.
And it wrecked the place, you know.
Because I think one of my favourite gigs that I went to was the Stranglers in the Ulster Hall.
Yeah.
And it was just after I had electrocuted myself, as you do.
Yes.
And so I had every finger was wrapped up in bandages, was burnt and with a sling. And these Stranglers, I go, "My, that's amazing." And I went, "Well, thanks very much, but actually, you know, it is a wound." They thought I was there like the Hooded Claw with the hand in bandages. But I loved it. The Stranglers were brilliant. Going to see Billy Connolly with the big banana feet in his early gigs as well. Yeah.
I actually, at that gig, it was in the ABC as was then, before they divided it up, and it was 3,800 people. And I'm sitting in the dress circle at the end of a row. And at one point, I laughed so much, I actually fell out of my seat onto the aisle and rolled over. I was at the other side and this woman says to me, "Are you all right, son?" I said, "Yeah, I'm grand, thanks." We could talk all day. I can see from Neil's despairing looks that we have probably gone on for longer than we should, but there you are.
Have we run out of tape?
To be honest, I've no idea, but
because our clues used to be when you'd hear it going
tick, 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 tick. Yeah, that's right.
We are that old.
Yeah. We are. What did you call those big tape recorders?
Reel to reel.
Yeah, no, but the
Yes, it was that Sennheiser or something. Yes, Sennheiser or something like that.
Anyway, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you with us here, hasn't it?
Yes, and thanks for coming. And
James, an absolute pleasure. And I'll see you in the palace, son.
Yes, I see you, though.
Bring your staff with you.
Am I allowed to bring my PA with
you
me?
May,
yeah.
You know, other people doing it is bad enough that you started, you know. Are you James's daddy?
Yes.
Didn't you used to be Ivan Martin? I did.
Well, my mum's one that she always said, she lost it one day, because she said all her life she had been Jessie and Joe's daughter. Yes. Then she was Terry's sister.
Yes.
Then she was Bob's wife.
Yes.
Then she was Peter, Pamela and Susan's mother. But when she was out one day walking the dog and somebody said, aren't you the owner of that lovely golden Labrador? She went, that's it. I am a person in my own right.
Yeah.
I am Edna.
Yes, that's right. I know. But such is life. Well, look, continued success.
Thank you.
Continued good health.
Thank you.
And continue to enjoy yourself, as if I needed to say that.
Well, all right. Thanks for your permission.
Thanks a lot.